All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Closing in on the 900th episode. Closing in on the evacuation of the garage. I don't know if that's the right word. Closing in on the transition. That's it. The transition to the new garage. To the garage with a bathroom. Yeah, but it's a slow go. It's a slow burn. It's a slow process because I have the time. I've given myself the time. I moved my entire house to the new house, a few boxes at a time. Just not freaking out, going through stuff. The big stuff I got some help with, but I unloaded a lot of the big stuff. But if you can do it that way, which I guess most people can't, it's really the way to do it. Just, take a couple of months and just chip away. And that's sort of what's happening here in the garage. I'm just starting to box some stuff up. I'm doing some recording while I do it. And I'm having emotional reactions to everything that I put in the boxes. Some stuff is going. Some stuff is out. But it's been exciting. It's been exciting doing all the work on the house that I should have done while I was living in it for my own happiness, for whoever gets it. Right? Unless at the last minute I'm like, I can't do it. Today is Monday. And today on the show is Ted Danson is here. Ted Danson, who honestly, my first real recollection of Ted Danson, right now he's in that NBC show called The Good Place, and they just finished up their second season. You can watch episodes on demand and catch up with season one on Netflix if you like. But my first recollection of Ted Danson was in the movie Body Heat, Larry Kasdan's film noir with William Hurt and Richard Crenna, and Ted Danson plays the fucking dancing DA. And, I remember seeing him in that movie just thinking, like, who is that guy? And I love William Hurt. And Danson, like, just was right, just kind of held his own, man. And then later, obviously, he went on to Cheers and everything else. But he was a great film actor. In that movie, he was tremendous. And I'm going to talk to him about that. Oh, yeah, I wanted to read this email because I found this to be provocative to me because the guy is right. The guy is right. High school theater subject line. Hey, Mark, M-A-R-K, it's fine. I'm a retired high school drama teacher, and I have to say that as I catch up on the podcast, something that you've been saying is really bothering me. You have been verbally cringing with a number of guests about performing in high school plays. I think that memory and photos and even videos do not begin to capture the experience of either the performers or the audience of a good production. The actual theater experience involves imaginative work from the audience, voluntarily suspending disbelief and participating in the event. The physical factors, crap beards, dodgy costumes, sets, etc., that make the pictures of productions look so bad are precisely the things we ignore when caught up in theater when it is working. So don't put down your work as a student actor. It might have been good after all. It might have been my best work, buddy. But he says, or I'm full of shit and my work life was self-delusion and sadness. Thanks for reading this, Greg. I think that Greg makes a good point, and I'm glad it turned around there at the end because I thought he said I was condescending to high school productions. Maybe I have been a little bit, but having been in one or two, and those memories of that, like, what were we getting away with? Well, really, the objective is to tell the story and enable the audience of whatever age or whatever their judgment is to engage in the story. I think a lot of times when you're in high school productions, the parents are like, oh, look, they're so cute. But I do not think it is impossible or in any way a long shot that, high school productions can be tremendous. It's about getting into those characters and getting that story out there. I've been thinking a lot about actors lately. I've been thinking a lot about the profession itself. I've been thinking about the natural, if somebody has a natural capacity to engage their vulnerability and their humanity within a character, that's the gift. That's the gift. Whatever the character is, it's really what's important is being present, being vulnerable, and being sort of human in those roles, not stiff in any way. I'm going to talk to David Mamet later this week a little bit about that and about some other stuff. But nonetheless, these are the things that's kicking around my brain, folks. This is it. This is it. There's always a lot going on in my mind, and there is a bit going on around here in terms of transitions and repairs and moving and grief in the sense of moving on. But I'm okay. I ate 3 candy bars last night. That's a red flag. Someone keeps bringing boxes of candy bars to the Comedy Store and putting them in the back for everybody. And, you know, if I'm running around, I did 4 sets the other night in the building. Why not slam a Snickers? Why not slam a Butterfinger, even if that wasn't your candy bar? I didn't even have a candy bar. My mom did not make me so afraid of chocolate and sugar. There was no fucking way I was going to eat a candy bar. Then I had a Rice Krispies treat. My neighbor, when I was growing up, Gary, his dad had vending machines, so there was candy bars in his garage. Do you remember a candy bar? Am I making it up? I think it was called 7-Up. It had nothing to do with the soda, but it had 7 sections, and each section was a different type of candy bar, like different type of filling. Is that right? Was it called 7-something? Am I making this up? Let me know. Let me know, please, people. Because this is how I learn things. All right, so Ted Danson. This was a very exciting thing to me. He's a very pleasant guy, and I enjoyed talking to him. Hung out, never met him before. Almost met him on the red carpet at the SAG Awards, but I instead took a picture of the back of his head and posted it on Instagram because I'm an immature idiot. But this is me and Ted Danson doing the thing, doing the talking to each other thing. Oh, that was Siri? Do you engage Siri?
I'll do wake-up calls with Siri.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'll say, wake me in a half hour.
Oh, does that work?
Nap. Yeah, and it really does.
You can just do that?
Yeah.
See, there's so many things I don't know about anything, about my phone.
You're not addicted then?
No, I can't stop looking at the news and hurting myself. But I mean, I'm addicted in the sense that I need to update constantly on what's happening in the world. But in terms of actually using it as something, you know, as a tool.
Yeah.
You never know that stuff until you just told me. I wouldn't have thought to do it, but why not do it? As opposed to set the clock with my fingers. Until someone teaches you anything, you don't know how to use anything. There's no manual for this shit. And these things are so much smarter than us, all of them, that you don't know until someone goes, oh, you can just do that one thing. And you're like, oh, I was doing 9 things. I didn't know.
I was always that way. If a model airplane or something, you had to read the instructions, then I was out.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I feel that way too. IKEA furniture is a big challenge.
Yes. Going to IKEA is a big challenge.
Exhausting, dude. Exhausting. Home Depot, terrible. Yeah. Terrible. Do you do that still, or have you got people?
I love going shopping. I have tons of people, but I love going shopping.
Yeah.
I love going to the supermarket.
Yeah,
me
too.
I love going to hardware stores.
Hardware store is good.
The best.
Yeah. Yeah. Hardware store, supermarket's fine. Home Depot, it's a whole other animal. Yeah. It's not, you can't find anything. If you're there for a small item, it's a terrible experience. And you realize just how much you don't know about construction and how things are made.
Yeah.
So Santa Monica is where you drove from?
Yes. Yes. Rustic Canyon.
Oh, yeah?
Do you know that area?
I don't.
God, it's like, it's below Will Rogers Park, below the Palisades, and it's had rivers down there.
Yeah?
They have redwoods. We have trees all over the place.
Is it new? Do you just got it? You just moved there? You've been there a while?
No, we've been there 2 or 3 years now.
And it's just a complete wilderness?
Feels that way. You don't feel like you're in L.A. You feel like you're in Northern California.
Oh, that's great. Like Big
LA
Sur?
L.A. style. Yeah, L.A. style, Big Sur.
And why do you, I guess you got to stay here for business, but how long have you been out here? You've been
kids,
out here?
Kids. We have kids.
How many kids?
And grandkids.
You have grandkids now?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what keeps you here.
And work.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you have another place in another state?
Yeah.
Where's that?
Back east, Martha's Vineyard.
Oh, so you go there too?
Yeah.
Martha's Vineyard. That's nice.
We got married there.
You and Mary?
Me and my wife, Mary Steenburgen.
The actress.
Yeah. The actress.
I saw you I saw you at the SAG Awards. I didn't introduce myself. I was literally right behind you on the line. And it was the first photo I took and Instagrammed was the back of your head.
And I bet you didn't have to put my name. I get recognized in airports away from people.
I thought that was that was what was great about it, is that it was clearly, there's no mistaking the back of your head.
I literally will walk by and it's people in an airport and they'll go, is that? Then they'll walk past me and I realize they're looking at my bald spot. They're going, yeah, that's him.
It's not the bald spot. It's the shape of your head. And you're also 9 feet tall. I mean, they're not going like, that's the bald Ted Danson. They're saying that head is a signature head.
But why only from behind?
Well, you have a certain hairstyle. I don't think so, because you've spent your life trying to avoid people seeing that, right?
By being tall.
Right, but so they don't know. But that's what people, when I posted it, they're like, Ted's going to be mad at you because it's a bald spot. I'm like, no, he's not. It's about his head.
That's my signature.
But you're keeping it up front.
So the rest of it is the world's problem.
How many kids do you have?
I have two. Mary has two. So we have four together and then three grandkids.
Four together, but not together.
So, correct.
Right. Sorry, both from previous marriages.
Joined together, we have four kids.
And how many grandkids?
Three.
That's exciting.
Oh, it is.
And they're all here?
They're all in, yes.
Around?
Around, yeah.
And show business, the kids?
I'm trying to figure out in my sleepy state. Forgive me. I got up at 3 this morning for some crazy
reason. You want that? Here's water there for you. Yeah, I would have offered you coffee, but I don't have the capacity anymore. There's nothing in my house.
No, this is
3 in the morning you woke up?
That's me swallowing.
That was very good. Well done. A lot of craft.
I did. I made coffee, so I'm, you know, you didn't the coffee's try to, wearing off.
You didn't try to go back to sleep?
No. No. Once I'm up, I'm up.
Really?
It's nasty.
I wake up earlier now, too. It drives me nuts.
Yeah.
But not three's rough, because it's still
three
dark.
Three, it was crazy.
And for no reason. You're no just reason. Up.
Yeah. Yeah. But what was the question?
Show business, kids in show business?
Yeah, and I was trying to figure out how much, they're not crazy about it when I talk about them that much. But no, but let me go. We have, you know, like Charlie McDowell is a director.
Oh yeah, I saw him at a party. I did not introduce myself.
You don't introduce yourself to many people, do you?
No, I do.
In my family.
I do. I don't know what to say all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes.
Oh, that's my life.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know we were going to talk when I saw you at the thing the other day. And, you know, if I introduce myself, there's always the risk because, you know, I'm there on the red carpet, but who am I really? It's my own insecurity. I'm going to go, hi, Ted Danson, I'm Mark Maron. You're like, nice to meet you. You're not going to take the time to go, who are you? What do you do? Are you with this? Are you, you know what I mean?
I might have given you my generic, hey.
Well rehearsed with the slight recognition almost.
It means everything. Hey.
Makes people feel good. It's familiar.
And clearly I know you.
Right.
I wouldn't have given you that.
Yeah,
hey.
Of course. Yeah. Very polished. And I'm glad that you got that succinct. But the McDowell kid, I saw at a party with his father, who I would have liked to introduce myself to. But again, Malcolm McDowell, what am I going to say to him? Good job.
Hey, yeah, good job. Unbelievable. Man, he was at the center of kind of British film when it made that amazing turn.
Oh, Lucky Man.
Oh, Lucky Man.
And Clockwork Orange. And then, like, there's a long, you know, that's what he's recognized for his life. He's going to be the guy from Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of work, though. He's nonstop.
No, he's great.
No, you're right. Well, that's
the interesting about you, man. I mean, you could have been, say, I'm alone for the rest of your life, but you're Ted Danson. That's not easy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I was lucky. I was lucky in that I was lucky enough to be on really good writers.
Yeah.
And if the writers make a story that's compelling and a character that's interesting, then you can get out of that typecast place you were.
I guess so. You think that's what it is? I think it depends what people's relationship is with that character. And although that relationship was, you know, I would imagine it's like for the other guys, for the secondary characters on that show, the guys at the bar.
Right.
Like, they're always going to be those guys. You know, Went and the postman guy, right?
Right, John.
Yeah. Like, you're never going to disconnect them. But for some reason, though, you were the center of that thing, you've become Ted Danson.
Well, a little bit, because my character's job, my job as an actor, was to let the audience in. I wasn't supposed to be.
You were the portal?
Yeah, I was the portal and not the crazy zany. I was more sane.
You were the codependent at the center of the whole thing.
Yes, my job was to love everyone else and their craziness.
What a job.
Yeah. No, it was great because I truly do love them. They were astounding.
Yeah. Such a funny show, yeah. Obviously. I don't think I've talked to any of the other people from that show. But there's a weird thing about that show in me, about Cheers, is that when I was in college in Boston, I went to that bar my freshman year. Like, what time? When did Cheers start?
The Bull 82? You went to the Bull and Finch.
82 was it? Beginning?
82.
So like 81, my freshman year of college, we were just in Boston, me and this kid, Renee, and we went to that place. And Rhea Perlman and Danny DeVito were in the bar that night,
really?
Like looking at it, scouting it, because I guess it had been written or pitched and, you know, she was going to be in it. I don't know what their involvement was, but we were there the night that they were there sitting there looking at it.
That's true. That's a true story because they did that.
They did it, right?
Yeah, and you saw them. That's amazing.
I did. It was crazy because, like, I didn't know anything. I was like, that's Danny DeVito, you know, from probably Cuckoo's Nest was my point of I have a weird point of reference with him. I thought he was amazing in Cuckoo's Nest.
Unbelievable.
As Martini.
Yeah.
Just sitting there putting things in his mouth and, like, it was great. So where did you come from?
Where did I come from? I came from, how far back are we going?
All the way.
Arizona.
Really?
Well, I came from San Diego.
You were born in San Diego?
Yeah.
So you're a California guy.
California, well, right after the Navy war's over guy. So then
your dad?
My dad was in the Navy. And so and then we went to Colorado. Then he was an archaeologist, anthropologist, my daddy.
For the Navy?
You know what? By the way, if I had gotten a full 8 hours sleep, I wouldn't be any quicker.
I'll keep you on top of it.
Yeah.
He's an anthropologist before he went into the Navy, and then he continued his anthropology.
Correct. Started teaching in Tucson. Then
University of Arizona?
Yeah. Yep.
So I like Tucson.
It is. It's pretty much the coolest city in...
So you were a kid in Tucson?
Until I was about 8. Then we went to Flagstaff, Arizona.
Not so cool. A little lean.
Lean, yeah. Now supposedly different because of the university up there is like taking off.
Oh, really?
But I was outside the city. I grew up 3.5-4 miles outside of Flagstaff. My father was the director of the museum and the research center, but it was a big deal.
Yeah,
because you go from 13,000 feet on the top of the San Francisco Peaks all the way down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So every ology in the world there, paleontology, everything, geology, archaeology.
It's an amazing resource.
And it was also dedicated to the Hopi, Navajo, Zuni, and Pueblo Indians.
Right.
In that they wanted to stimulate their culture and make sure that it didn't go away, the arts and the crafts. So my best buddies growing up were all Hopi, Navajo, and ranchers, sons and daughters. Yeah, literally. I mean, it was like jump on a horse and come back at night kind of growing up.
You rode horses?
Yeah, it was actually really genuinely cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And were you taken in terms of as family or friends with the indigenous people? I mean, did you have an experience with that?
Yeah. Yeah,
cuz that's such a unique experience that nobody...
It is. Especially the Hopi is what I knew more. My friend Raymond Coyne, the Hopi live basically on three mesas up in northern Arizona, and they've lived there forever.
Yeah.
They never went to war with the United States, so they never got moved anywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
it's not a reservation by virtue of being moved.
Correct.
It's probably a reservation, but it was always there.
And one of the oldest inhabited village in the country is in Walpi, is in the Hopi mesas.
And you've been up there?
Yeah. And so I would go, if you could read a book about the Hopi and probably know more than I do, but my best friends and I played in and out of the plazas where the kachinas would dance and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It was really amazing.
It is amazing to have a little bit. I grew up in northern New Mexico. I grew up in Albuquerque.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, I mean, but I mean, I have that. I didn't have friends that were, you know, lived in on the reservation or were Indians.
But you had the Pueblos.
Yeah, but the culture was there. Yeah. You know, like you go to the state fair, you go to Indian Village, you eat the fried bread, you see the dance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's a very limited experience. I can't really call myself as a, you know, like, I've had some experience with the indigenous people of the United States. I went to the state fair and ate the bread.
And the Spanish.
Yes.
That's a very...
Yeah.
Albuquerque's, I don't know, I shouldn't call it tough, but it is.
It is a little rough now. It has been. I don't know why. Do you shoot there ever?
I visited Mary, who shot there. I've never shot there.
Yeah. I mean, when I grew up, I didn't know better. I mean, but it was always, there was always a sort of high violence rate, but it was not,
homeless,
I didn't notice it. Yeah. That came later.
That came later.
Yeah. I mean, I was out years ago. You know, I don't have any real.
How old are you?
54. My dad's there. He's still in New Mexico, but he seems to, I don't know. He's managing to somehow be off the grid and still in it.
In Albuquerque or nearby?
He's pretty much in Albuquerque by the mountains, but he lives in his own world and with a little bit of Fox TV added.
Does he listen to you?
I don't think he claims he can't figure out how to do it. So it's been,
how to let his son in.
Yeah, exactly. It's been 8 years, and you know, when I wrote a book, that got to him, but the podcast not so much. Yeah, you live with it. You know, if you got a dad that's weird, it's just the way it is. But your dad wasn't, it sounds like.
No.
It sounds like he wasn't. A decent guy with a noble purpose.
He was a good guy.
Yeah.
He was a good guy. He loved people. He loved being around people. He was
He
was thoroughly embarrassing. I mean, you know, he was the guy who would tell his joke just a little bit louder in the restaurant.
Yeah.
Hoping that the table next door would get in on it.
Oh,
and they would.
Yeah.
You know.
Good jokes.
It didn't matter. They were just horribly embarrassing.
Oh, so he liked bringing people in.
Yes. He would buy, if he didn't get two or three other tables enjoying his joke.
Yeah, that's good. You know? Yeah. So he was a real center of attention guy.
He was.
But like, did he go on digs and stuff? Did you go on digs? And
I did. That was very cool. Like in Tucson, there'd be the archaeological summer camp for the students up in the White Mountains, Apache Reservation, near Globe. And I'd be 4 or 5 years old, and they let the little kids play in the trash heaps, the ancient trash heaps.
Oh, yeah.
So where, you know, they'd throw the
pieces of ceramics,
600 years ago, they'd throw the broken pots away.
Right.
And as soon as you found anything, though, if you found a bone.
Yeah.
You know, or a piece of turquoise.
Get out of the way, kid.
You were out.
let the pros in with the brooms and the dusters.
Yeah.
But you find little shards of pottery and stuff?
Pottery, yeah. That I could spot, on horseback, I could spot turquoise beads riding without getting off.
Were that good, huh?
Yeah. And you knew where to look.
Yeah.
You know, anthills. You'd look at
anthills. Oh, because they do the digging?
Yeah, they do the digging for you, and then you'd spot these little
things. That's a good trick for people that are into that.
Yeah.
The anthills, they've already done some of the work for you. But what it sounds like were you riding bareback? Come on.
My father wouldn't let me ride with a saddle unless I was with another person. On my own, I had to ride bareback.
Why?
The fear is if you fall, you get hung up on a saddle.
And dragged?
And get really hurt.
Oh.
But if you fall bareback, you just break something and you're fine.
Oh, man. So when was the last time you got on? Did you have to do any horse? Like, I don't remember you in a movie where you had to ride a horse.
Not really. I did a movie called Cowboy, TV movie called Cowboy.
Yeah.
I got to tear ass around on a horse.
Did you impress everybody? Did it come right back to you? Is it like riding a bike?
A little bit.
Yeah.
The technique is like riding a bike. Your body, though, you know, is like, no, get off. Don't do this.
These days are over.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And horses, if you have a great horse, then you have a chance of being a good rider. But if you have a bony, you know, poorly gated horse, you're just in trouble.
I'm terrified of them. I went to a camp up in Pecos. Where we were assigned a horse, Pecos, New Mexico. Yeah. It's pretty up there.
Gorgeous, great fishing.
Yeah, yeah, trout fishing, right? In the river there, the Pecos River. But I was assigned a horse and it bit me, and I just can't stand them. And I can't. Yeah. I'm too scared, and they know it, and it's terrible.
They do, because they have the brain the size of a walnut, but intuition.
Is it really a walnut size?
Yeah, little brain, but totally intuitive.
Yeah, well, that's they're animals.
So, Yeah.
Right.
Here comes Mark, who's terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. They know. Like cats, I have several cats, and they all have different personalities, and they all sort of act in response, in reaction to me. Yeah. Like, I always wondered, like, why do I get all these skittish, weird cats? Never, I didn't blame myself for years. I just thought I had bad luck, and yeah. I'm like clearly making them all nervous.
I'm feeling a little skittish. But not bad. I'm calming down.
Yeah.
I'm calming down.
Well, it's like it was, you know, it's a long drive and you don't know what you're getting into and it feels odd. You're like, why am I in this neighborhood? Yeah. What is this neighborhood?
No, I was actually kind of excited. I was terrified that I didn't have, that I was going to be sleepy, tired.
Oh.
Crazy brain. By the way, I listened to Richard Jenkins.
Oh.
Who's just one of my favorite actors.
Yeah. Yeah, he's something, huh?
Yeah. My wife, Mary, worked with him on Step Brothers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were just great.
She's
together.
Very funny in that movie. That's a goofy movie. I like...
He can do anything.
He can. Literally. It seems like you as well can, and I think that he can. It seems like, you know, because I think about, like, the first time I saw you was in Body Heat. And I remembered it because I was sort of a film, a little bit nerdy in high school. But like when Body Heat, I was a huge William Hurt fan came out. Yeah. When Lawrence Kasdan, you know, I don't know why I was into him, but we were excited about Body Heat when I was in high school. What was that, like 80? What, 80?
Ooh, yeah.
79?
Yeah, about 80. You're right.
Yeah. And like, you know, I was like, who's that guy? Yeah. Who's the dancing DA?
DA. And I'm not a dancer, but what we had was a writer's strike or somebody struck, some union
struck. Oh, really?
Struck. And what went from a 2-week rehearsal became a 2-month rehearsal. And we just kept rehearsing until the strike was over, and then we went and shot it.
So you actually learned how to dance?
Yeah,
is that what
I
you're
had
saying?
A choreographer who worked with me for 2 months. We'd go into parking lots and learn how to dance off car bumpers or, you know.
It's interesting that it was a decided, character behavior.
Oh.
It was written in.
No, in the script. You can literally take that script and that you auditioned with and go to the movie and conduct it like a score. Literally everything is in it.
Huh.
He wrote it, rewrote it. He storyboarded the film so that we would shoot a half a master, a third of a close-up, because he just literally knew every shot that he needed.
And he's a smarty.
Yeah, he's really smart.
Like, he's sharp. You know, it's a challenging thing to do a film noir in the modern world because so many of them fall flat. You know, when you think of contemporary film noirs or even, you know, post-film noir time, you know, you come up with Chinatown. It's always Chinatown, right?
Yeah.
So now you've got L.A. Confidential, Chinatown, and Body Heat, I think, are solid.
Yeah,
For the genre. But I there have been other ones.
The music was amazing.
In Body Heat? I'm trying to remember. Yeah, it's kind of dramatic.
John Williams. I think it was.
But how do you get into acting? Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a sister, Jan, who I just spoke to on the way here.
Yeah. Is she all right?
She's good.
What does she do?
She's married. She's very involved in the Episcopal Church.
Oh, yeah?
The case of her church means she's working with migrant workers a lot and immigration issues and things like that in Arizona.
Did you grow up Episcopal?
I did, yes.
What is it?
Acolyte, yes.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
What does that mean? Is that
the guys that come out before the priest and light the candles.
Oh, it's an acolyte in the Episcopal. Yeah. I don't know anything about the Episcopal Church. Where does that
come
from?
It's a... I don't know if this is accurate or just a joke, but it's like a watered down version of Catholicism.
Oh, so it's
very, very next door.
Oh, rooted in Catholicism.
It's the Church of England.
Oh,
so
right.
The Pope is not
the guy.
And all.
I got it.
Yeah.
Religious upbringing?
You know, church every Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't something that we was preached at us, you know,
right?
But
you weren't brought up terrified of hell. And,
no. It was very. It was a happy place, and some of my best friends went there. And
so community thing.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I've talked to other people.
But I
also
was at the same time I was going to church every Sunday. I was going to the Hopi dances and watching people worship their gods.
Yeah.
The same way they had in the same place for the last 500-600 years, and it was very real.
Yeah.
So it was never my way or the highway when it came to spirituality.
And you registered that at that age, though? You registered that?
I don't think like I am right now talking to you, but yeah.
Right.
I mean, it was...
This is how they worship.
Yeah.
And this is how we do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Much
we had
different.
Mormons around and all of that. I felt a little sad for the Mormons
around.
Because
they were around in pockets.
They had come down from, they had drifted south of Utah.
They ended up in southern New Mexico too,
yeah,
I think, in Silver City. And yeah, the Mormons are spreading out.
I had a handful of friends at an early age. I felt sad that only Mormons got to go to heaven, because that must have made him feel kind of bad playing with us. So I remember thinking, that must feel bad.
That's in the book? That's in the Book of Mormon, that only Mormons go to heaven?
I think basically that's why they're so good with ancestry.
Uh-huh.
I shouldn't be saying they. I don't really know what I'm talking about. But no, they are great at ancestry.
Sure,
because
they,
I think
they
if
got
you,
a hollowed out mountain with everybody's name in it.
Because... If I'm a Mormon and I marry non-Mormons, then it would be horrible if you would be saying to your bride that none of your parents are in heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can retroactively get everybody in.
Oh, that's it. That's what I know I go to Salt Lake to work sometimes, and I'm fascinated with the whole thing. They're generally pretty pleasant.
Oh, and do amazingly good deeds out in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, they put their actions.
Sure.
Know,
sure. Yeah, they tend to go a little Republican, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah. What are you gonna do?
So how do you get into acting?
My sister goes away. This is in Arizona, and we didn't have great school systems at that point, and I was a lazy student. My sister was going away to Wellesley.
Oh, that's
my
a good
rancher,
school.
Yes. My rancher friends who had been homeschooled were then being sent away to school, and I was like, wait, whoa, don't leave
me
behind. And so it was my idea, but at age 13, I was sent away or got to go away to Kent School for Boys, which was an Episcopal church school.
Where?
In Kent, Connecticut.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a big shift.
It was.
That's like little outfits. Kids who didn't have horse experience.
Yeah.
Kids who didn't have
Or
Indian
they had
experience.
Very expensive horses that knew how to jump.
Oh, they had those?
Yeah.
So that was always a full range, huh? Mostly really rich kids or what?
No, you know what? It was really interesting. You paid how much you could pay. It was on a sliding scale. So you had kids from the inner city. You had the son of the head of Ford Motor Company. You know, it was a huge range of people.
And so what was it? And you were 13?
I was 13.
That's a pretty pivotal time. All boys?
All boys. It's a miracle. You're looking at a miracle.
Yeah.
After an all boys school,
But you sought it out.
Yeah, I did.
You wanted to get out because your friends were leaving? And
I thought it sounded adventuresome. I got to get on the Santa Fe Super Chief.
Oh, you took the train all the way across?
All the way across.
Oh, that's exciting.
Because it was snowing so much in the winter that it was easier to do that.
By yourself you went on the train?
Uh-huh.
Oh, at 13?
Oh, it was amazing.
Steward took care of you?
Yeah.
Kept an eye out?
Or you'd go to the dining room.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I was 14 when it started.
It's great.
You'd end up in, you'd go to Chicago, then you'd take the 20th Century Limited down to Grand Central, and then you'd have an hour and a half to
get on the commuter line.
Yeah, no, you'd go to Times Square and just go, oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. This is in the 60s.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Where am I? And then you'd run back to Grand Central, and you'd get on this special two-car train that took you to Kent School for Boys.
Right to the school?
Yeah, and you never left
that was
until
it.
The holiday. You couldn't go to town. You couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
It was just very strict.
The train's so great. I took it after college. I had some sort of romantic beatnik idea about taking the train from New York to New Mexico. And I crapped out in Austin. I was like, I'm getting on a plane.
So did you go to Chicago and then down?
Yeah. I went to Chicago and I think all the way down to Memphis and across the bottom.
Oh, Southern Pacific.
Yeah. Because I know I ended up in Memphis. But Chicago was great. It's a great station to go into.
Yeah.
It must have been much different, though, in the 60s.
It was incredible.
It was still beautiful, but it was, you know, this was 1987.
Was it Amtrak by then?
It was definitely Amtrak.
Because back when it was not Amtrak,
yeah,
when it was, you know, the Santa Fe,
yeah,
It was just.
It sort of had some
linens and silverware and
really still
chefs that made meals and.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was really spectacular.
Oh, that's a great experience to have had. Yeah, so you go to the boys' school. What are you, sportsman?
Basketball saves my life. I just loved it. It was my passion.
You killed in the basketball.
In a small school kind of way. Yeah. It was pretty good. And then Stanford. I went to Stanford University.
Well, that's good. You got into a good college after all.
But literally.
Yeah.
Did nothing.
At Stanford or to get there?
Both.
It was all basketball?
I was never a I'm not a great student.
Yeah.
But because I kind of know I'm not a great student, I'm kind of, I don't really care about tests and exams. I find them kind of like a puzzle, kind of fun, because I'm probably not going to do great on it.
And right.
I don't beat myself up about that. So
really?
I test really high. So I used to get into things.
You test high just because you like to be challenged by them, but you don't freak out about it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. As a matter, I got into advanced placement English at Stanford University because of tests I took at the end of Kent, right? And my teacher at Kent said, for someone who has the least amount of native intelligence, you got one of the highest scores. Which is a problem, because then I went to the advanced placement English class, freshman Stanford, and not only could I not understand what the professor was saying, I had no idea what the student next to me had even asked them. I was so over my head.
Really?
Yeah.
In advanced placement English?
Yeah.
What could have been so cryptic?
I have no idea. Maybe.
Were you speaking middle English?
The combination of words. I don't know.
I mean, I have not had the experience with English except for middle English when you're reading those old poems.
You know, I'm fairly smart.
Yeah.
But I'm not someone who can impress you with my intelligence.
Sure. No, I get it. I get it. Yeah, yeah.
But people who impress you with their intelligence usually are boring as batshit.
Sometimes. Yeah, I think that's true. Or else they make you feel
if they're trying to impress you with their intelligence, then...
Right.
I'm out. The ones that I shouldn't make generalities. The ones that I enjoy the most or appreciate the most are the people that don't make me feel stupid.
Right.
That their ideas, no matter how brilliant, are communicated to me in a way.
Absolutely.
Where I go, oh, wow, of course, I understand.
Or they sort of spark you to be like, I got to figure out what the fuck that was.
Because if I'm not understanding your communication and you're communicating to me, then fuck you.
Right. And if you're doing that on purpose, fuck you again.
Yeah.
You're trying to condescending fucker.
Yes.
I know exactly that feeling. It happens less as we get older, though, doesn't it?
The which?
Being condescended to by, super smart.
Yes, you know, you do get a pass if you've been around. I've reached the Mr. Danson stage of my career, and I'm getting a lot of passes. I really am.
That's what you work for.
Yeah.
You know, you things that used to bother you don't anymore, and people give you a pass. It's the freedom of aging. So when do you get into acting? How does that happen?
Okay, then I go to Stanford, and I think basketball. So I
What position do you play?
Forward.
Yeah.
At 6'2".
Yeah.
And
that's short, right?
Yeah, very short. And maybe on a good day, touch the rim. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about a jumper.
Yeah.
We're not talking any real skills, to be honest. Just loved it. Passionate.
Yeah.
So I show up.
But this is a theme with you, both in scholastic work, just passion and and the challenge of tests, and then with basketball.
I have no real talent at anything, really, except I'm a great appreciator. I appreciate like crazy. I will make you feel good. I'm a good cheerleader.
Yeah.
But that's really basically what I have to offer the world. I will appreciate the hell out of you.
Yeah, but no, do you have a talent? Let's not diminish the...
But the first thing I talked to you about was Sam Malone and his job, my job as an actor, was to appreciate the people around me.
Right.
I'm really good at that.
Okay, but you've done other parts. So unglued here.
All right, I'm being a little silly.
No, you're not being silly, but I mean, I don't, like, either you... As a creative person and as somebody in an actor, I would imagine if you think too much about it, you're like, what do I do? What do I do? You know what I mean? But you obviously have a talent.
Yes, I like make believe. I like to pretend.
There you go.
That
is essentially what acting is.
Yes, of course.
So you're at Stanford and
pretending that I'm a basketball player, and I go out.
But it seems like he actually did that.
I went to the freshman tryouts for freshman basketball same year that Lou Alcindor was a freshman at UCLA.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't even step on the court. I came up to the kind of the line.
Yeah.
And I just watched these people play for about 2 minutes and turned around
and walked,
sobbed a little, choked back tears. And then about a year and a half later at Stanford, stumbled into an audition following some girl I wanted to take out who had an audition.
Yeah.
And I went, can I come with you? And it was just like light bulbs, music.
Yeah.
Sledgehammer over the head. It was just, oh.
It was just for the non-theater school production of something? Like, what was it for?
It was for Bertolt Brecht's Man East Man.
Wow.
And I got the smallest part you could get in it and still be in the play. It was kind of cool there because they had, for about 3 or 4 years at Stanford, they had a small repertory of professional actors there.
Yeah.
And so they would help teach classes.
It was
really an amazing time. But then everyone said, and I pulled up my station wagon to the back of the studio theater and slept there. I just never left. Literally, I never went to any other classes. And people said, if you're serious, you should go back east. Then I went to Carnegie Mellon to really seriously study acting.
So you finished at Stanford and then?
No, I transferred after 2 years.
To Carnegie Mellon, to the act? That's a big one. That's
that was like Juilliard, Northwestern. You know, that was.
So was it an undergraduate program or a graduate?
Undergraduate.
So you stayed there another, couple of years?
Three and a half years, as a transfer student, I could leave in 3 years.
And that was where you put the craft together. That's where you learned how to do
it. Well, kind of. And then New York I studied again. I studied with a student of Sandy Meisner, who was the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Sure.
One of the great teachers.
Meisner Method.
Yeah.
I've talked to people about the Meisner Method.
You have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Repetition. Looking at each other. Yeah. Words over and over again.
You got a mustache.
I have a mustache.
You have a mustache.
I have a mustache.
You have a mustache.
I have a mustache.
Yeah, you're resigned to your mustache. And we're out. We just lost everyone.
Yeah, no, I got it. That's good. That's the best Meisner exercise I've done. But you found that helpful.
Totally. That kind of changed. I loved everything at Carnegie and learned a great deal.
You earned movement. But Carnegie's like structured, right?
Yes. You had dance. You had, voice. You had speech. You had acting. You had everything. But we got to get up and act every day. You got up and acted. So it was
You got
was
to play leads great. And everything. So
no, I never did. It's weird.
How is that possible?
I know. See, this is the phony fraud part of my brain when it comes to acting. I was never in a Shakespearean play. As soon as people start talking about Shakespeare, I start to sweat and think, I hope nobody asks me anything.
Yeah, in the same way.
I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah. So that makes you feel like a fraud?
A little bit.
The Shakespeare thing?
A little bit.
You've never, and to this day?
I mean, I love acting so much. I love being part of this community.
Yeah.
And I always, this is probably true for many actors, I always feel a little bit outside of the group.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, who do you consider to be the group? Like, who's the head of the group right now?
I don't know. I imagine that group changes. I'm not sure, but they can talk acting forever.
Yeah.
And directors and writers. And I get a little bored. I have to see if I really believe what I'm saying. I do feel like an outsider when it comes to serious actors.
Oh.
That's true.
Huh.
But then theater, New York.
Right.
Bill Hurt. Bill, who.
William. Yes. Sir.
William, who I,
I'm correcting you, and you know him. You call him Bill, and I just want to make sure people know who you're talking about. I call him William. I don't know what
William
you call
Hurt
him.
Was Bill. For me a source of guilt for a long time. I should never use anyone like that, but it was like, what would Bill Hurt do? Oh, he wouldn't take this part. Well, who cares?
I get that. I can see that. So, you do Body Heat with him, and at that time, he was like
Altered States.
Altered States.
He was huge.
He was huge because, I was into him, and I remember reading a Rolling Stone article about him.
Yeah.
This sort of tormented, intense, like The Big Chill. But, the weird thing is that, as people get older, their craft or whatever they are, it becomes rooted in a personality, and you can start to see their tics and habits that are repeated throughout roles, and their range varies. But you know, you start to see the person is just a person.
Yes,
and it's sort of interesting that I don't know if you found that.
No, that's true. You're absolutely. We have very few character actors who totally disappear, Alec Guinness. You know,
or Meryl Streep.
Yeah,
and she doesn't totally disappear, but she's pretty close.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Yeah, but I mean, but it seems like most actors are people that like even like Richard Jenkins, who's a great character actor, but he's not.
I remember you guys talking about that.
Yeah, he just shows up.
Yeah, and you wear a different outfit. The make believe circumstances are different.
Right.
And
he's very practical about it.
Yeah.
It's a different type of, I don't know. Like, I imagine the biggest challenge for actors is to realize that they are of this type of actor. That, you know, there are types of actors. Their approaches are different. And, you know, and some people have, you know, are just, you know, freaks in terms of what they can or can't do or what they want to challenge themselves with.
Yeah.
But a lot of people just sort of like, they like to play guys, you know, that do things. What, you know what I mean? You need those guys.
I usually suck the material down to my level. Pull it down to me.
but you, it's interesting though, because like it didn't seem like at the beginning you were necessarily going to be a comedic actor, and now you're like a funny guy.
Yeah, but I'm the funny guy who makes your really funny material funny. I don't fuck up your funny material.
Right.
But if your material's not funny, I'm not the guy who's going to make it funny. And some people can, you know.
You're also good at playing off really funny guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know, straight man. Yes. I know what to do with Larry David.
Right.
I know how to push him into a corner until he explodes and comes out more Larry.
Do you do that in real life?
Yes. Acting with Larry is very much like going out to dinner with him.
You guys are friends?
Yes. And you love him, so you want to make him laugh, and you usually do it by...
Yeah.
Insulting them somehow.
Oh, yeah. There are people that, you know, that comes through as affection somehow. That, you know what, you know, once you can disarm them enough to where they laugh, what they really want to do is cry.
He's really a generous laughter. A lot of people who do stand-up are not necessarily generous laughter.
Takes them a while. I think that I've done stand-up my whole life, and I didn't really start laughing again until I felt better about myself. So it's really hinging on whether or not that stand-up will ever... feel some sort of enough self-esteem to be comfortable laughing at others.
Yes, that's true.
That's really
smart.
It can either last a lifetime or maybe it gives way eventually, and you realize you like to laugh.
Yeah.
The real problem with stand-ups is like you get so jaded and you spend so much time in comedy clubs that you only laugh when someone else is doing badly.
There is something wonderfully funny, though, when a moment goes wrong,
even if
you're in that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just other people. I mean, we used to have hysterics on Cheers when something all week had been killer funny.
Yeah.
And then you deliver the killer funny, and the audience is like, you can hear a pin drop.
Nothing.
And it's like falling into through a trap door, and it's so fucking funny that you just fell through a trap door that we would all roll on the ground with hysterics.
And the audience wouldn't know why?
No.
You got cocky. Well, it's so funny because I was thinking like Becker, that character Becker that you did for a long time too. Those are the two shows you did the longest, right? Cheers and Becker.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's sort of a Larry David character in a way. Kind of a cranky, you know, guy that's annoyed at everything.
Dave Hackle wrote that, and it was so good after having such a memorable Sam Malone-like character to play. It was great to have something that was equally strong in a different direction.
And how do you like approach roles? So, I mean, like as an actor, do you make decisions? I mean, what are the decisions you make? I mean, when you're not playing yourself.
Which is never, because basically I play Sam Malone, became a doctor. Sam Malone works for the police.
So you started
CSI,
Sam Malone.
Sam Malone.
You started Sam Malone? You don't start a Ted Danson?
No, it's all Sam Malone.
How would Sam handle this?
How shall I do my hair? Sam do my hair?
But, you know, with Larry, you're an elevated part of yourself. Yeah. But it's not really you, right?
No. You know what I do?
It's not really Larry either. I met him once. I'd like to interview him, but he doesn't seem to want to. But I met him once. He's a lot nicer than he is.
He's got a huge heart of gold. Mary once told him, and almost brought tears to his eyes. She said, if I were ever really in trouble,
yeah,
you'd be one of the first people I'd ever call. He has a huge, generous heart of gold.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Very sweet. Very yeah. kind.
Is he hides it well.
Yes. Yeah, no, no. He is Looney Tunes when it comes to social niceties.
Yeah.
He does things like, let's all go out to dinner.
Yeah.
Great. And we all show up at the time at 8:30. Yeah. And he is sitting at the table halfway through his entree because he decided he'd rather do something else later that evening. And as you sit down, he's saying goodbye.
Really?
And literally, without any problem.
Yeah.
You won't accept invitations to people's homes for dinner anymore because it's too hard to get out of.
Yeah.
In a restaurant, you can do what he does.
Oh.
You know? So there's part of you that just wants to go, you know, grab him by the lapels and throw him on the ground. And, you know,
what the fuck's the matter with you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you do it with humor.
Right.
But that's your job.
So you just have to put up with that.
Or make fun, or laugh, or
but you're talking about it like this is a person that he's got this weird problem where you know we're always friend and we just didn't have to adapt to it.
Part of you admire it too,
yeah, right,
because you kind of wish you had come early and had your entree.
But what do you all just sit there without him? Then he just goes away, and then and that's just the way he is.
That's just the way he is.
So.
Let me go back and answer your question because
roles.
If you have to learn how to do something, you know, shoot a bow and arrow, and you're not good at it, so you practice.
Right.
You practice the stuff you don't know how to do. I should say not you, but I practice the stuff I don't know
right.
how to do. But then, to me, if it's really good writing,
yeah,
I just keep trying on the words over and over and over and over and over and over again, and the words start to play you. If they're good words, they start to play you kind of like an instrument. And
you just
go with where they're leading you.
Right.
And good writing does that. Good writing is just delicious. You just hop on board. And,
I think that's true, yeah.
You know,
right, and you just kind of work it until it locks in because all the emotions should be in that, right? They should be there somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, and good writing they are.
And like I would imagine then when in playing like Bored to Death or playing comedy that isn't three camera comedy but has a little breath to it, you play it straight, right? You're not milking anything.
No.
You realize the idiosyncrasies of the character. Like in the character in Bored to Death is a very odd wealthy man, right?
Yes.
And in the dynamic between you and Schwartzman was great, but that character was like, what's wrong with this guy a little bit, but you know, it was very earnest.
And it was perfect for me. That's the other thing. If you're lucky, you find roles that are slightly, you know, that are perfect for what you're going through in life.
And
that was me at 60 going, I still want to be relevant. Don't leave me behind. What are you guys doing? I want to be with you. You guys are young. I want to be, you know.
Yeah.
I want a colonoscopy.
So it worked out.
Yeah.
But when you do something like, I mean, you did like 80 some odd episodes of CSI.
Ooh, that was hard. The people were incredibly sweet.
Yeah.
I loved going to work.
Yeah.
But it was so hard because it was like doing a soap opera.
Yeah.
You know.
Which you have done before.
Which I had done. And it was the scariest acting I've ever been involved with.
You started
soap opera.
Was that like your first job?
Yeah.
Why was it scary?
Because there's no humor.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
There's no, you know. If you were to hiccup or something, you would bring the tape to a grinding halt.
Right.
And you were repeating yourself, you know, the scenes where you remember what I said to you just like 2 seconds ago and then how I reacted that way. You know, so there's nothing natural about it. You're imparting information that you want the audience to remember.
Right.
And that's the same thing on CSI. You are constantly wanting them to follow each little scientific detail. So if you tell a joke or try to be funny at the end of a scene, that gets cut because you don't want people laughing at the end of the scene. You want them remembering.
So they can do the weird and suspenseful music.
Yeah.
And then,
so it was really hard, really hard.
Why'd you do it?
Partly to see if I could. Partly because I had a home in Martha's Vineyard that we were going to have to sell.
Yeah. if you didn't do it.
And this sounds disrespectful. I made great friends, love the writers, and I'm so grateful for what CSI gave me.
Right, good job. You know,
but it was one of the hardest. That's also true. It's one of the hardest jobs that I've ever done for me, Ted.
Right.
And it was also paid me really well. So, and I'm, that sounds cynical or bad, but it was great. They were very kind.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you're in a position where, you know, like a job that is challenging and it may not seem like the thing you want to do is something that is available to you. And as an actor, you can do it. It's an acting job.
Yeah.
And you need it to work.
And it taught me a lot. You know, it taught me, you know, I kind of bob and weave, and I'm usually, my characters are me or tilted a little bit to one side or the other. I'm never just John Wayne straight up and down.
Right.
You had to be straight up and down doing CSI.
Yeah.
You know, you were supposed to be a leading man. You weren't supposed to be bobbing and weaving. You were supposed to be standing and delivering.
Holding your ground.
Yes. Yeah. Which is terrifying to me. So I learned a lot by doing it.
Holding your ground. It's hard, huh? Oh, I understand that. But you, like, you came up doing all these, like, little, like, you were on all the weird little TV shows.
Yeah.
Laverne and Shirley, Benson, Magnum, like, you were doing bit parts.
Yeah.
So you, after, what was it, after New York, you just came out here and dug in?
Yeah. I would, but even, I would in New York, I'd be doing something, a play.
Yeah.
And I would go be an extra in a commercial. I really didn't care. I didn't care if I was acting in class or acting being paid.
Yeah.
All I wanted to do was act. And truthfully, that's still my truth.
Yeah?
Maybe
you
not,
love it.
Maybe not the pay part. I like being paid a little.
Right. No, pay's great. You know, but like, it's interesting because, you know, I started doing it a little more, you know, coming this new show, Glow, on Netflix.
Right.
And I'd done a show that was centered around me for IFC. But like, I kept trying to think as a comic and as a guy who does what I'm doing now, and it's just a kind of a guy who just engages spontaneously in things, the job of acting. The one thing that I locked into was that, you know, when you do a lot of sitting around and you do a lot of coverage, and you know that.
Right.
So, like, if you like acting a lot, you have to sort of be excited every time when it's your turn.
Right.
Right? You can't just be like, oh, fuck. Why?
Right.
So, like, you really, and I started to realize that. I'm like, instead of like complaining that, you know, to myself that I'm here for 13 hours and I'm shooting, you know, maybe 3 minutes of this, that like when I do get my shot, I should enjoy it because that's the fun of acting.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's TV too. And live TV is different than, you know, than not live TV.
Yeah.
But you don't do a lot of stage shit, do you?
Uh-uh.
None.
No, I'm too chicken. At this point, I'm too chicken. I'd do it if Mary and I could find something to do together.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about needing to fill the coffers kind of thing, but just go off and do something together. Yeah. I would do it.
Uh-huh.
I had one of those stick your finger in a light socket zap on stage maybe 10 years ago. The Atlantic Theater?
I do, in New York. Yeah, Mammoth's place.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Neil Pepe. Mary McCann. Uh-huh. Yes. Anyway, they were doing a month of celebrating all their 25 years of being in business. And so they had 25 playwrights write anything they wanted. It could be 20 minutes long, it could be a musical, it could be one act, whatever you want, write it. And they asked me if I'd be part of it. So I did. And I got a 20-minute monologue that was brilliant.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a lot of rehearsing. You just kind of throw it together, and then you do it for a week.
Right.
You know? And I came in to rehearse for a day with Neil Pepe, the artistic director, and I saw someone performing that night, their bit.
Yeah.
And he went up, because there's no real rehearsal. He went up for a line. So he called for a line.
Yeah.
And instead of it being whispered from the from the stage, it was in the back of the house from the booth over a microphone.
Yeah.
So there was no hiding. And I thought, oh, fuck, okay, I better at least be clever if I have to ask for a line. So this was a 20-minute, speedy, fast, verbal monologue.
Yeah.
About a guy every day he was trying to remember how his day started, and by the end he's troubled, and he's trying to work something out, and by the end of the day he's starting to remember in his recounting his day that he actually that his basement in his home is hell, the literal hell, that he walks downstairs into hell. So
this
every
is the
night.
Conceit of the monologue.
Yes, yeah. Right. So, anyway, I psyched myself out opening night. I walked out, and literally probably 9.5 seconds in to this 20-minute monologue, I just freeze. And it is like sticking your finger in a light socket. My entire body just went, you know, with adrenaline.
Room full of people?
Yes, room full of people. My daughter's there. Oh, my poor daughter. She's watching this. Should I cry? Fuck, I can't believe this. I'm so mad. Don't be mad. You're going to have to think of something, you know. In a split second, your mind just freaks.
Yeah.
I could get up and leave.
Yeah.
No, I can't. So I say to Darcy, the stage manager, Darcy, what happens next?
That's your opening.
Yeah. So Darcy is just sat down with her coffee going, you know, hasn't even opened the book probably. Goes,
right.
Oh, jeez. Thumbs through, tries to find my line, but she gives me the line that I had just finished saying before I forgot the next line.
Yeah.
So like an idiot, I took that and said the one line and then went, actually, Darcy, it's the next line I need. Oh, I had so much adrenaline running through my body that my poor daughter afterwards, and it was actually brilliant because I was so panicked, I was actually as panicked as my character, you know.
Yeah, but, afterwards.
Yeah, afterwards, after the 9.7.
But you got through it?
I got through it, and it was all fine and good, and I did it for the week. But my daughter literally had to walk me around a block in New York drinking like one of those huge liter bottles of water because I had so much toxic adrenaline in my body. I was
toxic
like shaking.
Adrenaline.
I was shaking.
Wow.
So when you say you're going to do another play, part of my body kind of...
When was that?
10 years ago.
That happened 10 years ago.
Yeah. And, let me just do a quick Neil Pepe. Sweet Neil Pepe, the artistic director.
Right.
Saw it happen, and he said after the show, why don't you come with me, and we'll go to the stage a half hour early, and we'll work together.
Because you had to do this how many times?
5 nights in a row. And he sat me down, and I did the monologue, and literally every time I got to that 9.5 second mark, that word, my body just jolted to a stop. And he just got me to say it over and over and over and over and over and
just because of that experience of the first, trauma.
The trauma. It was like post-traumatic stress. It was so that night when I did it, my body went at that same place.
Yeah.
But he had taught my mouth to keep flapping.
Oh, yeah.
That I got past it.
Interesting.
And, yeah. Saved my life. So, anyway.
But did you ever do extensive stage work?
In New York, I did a year and a half of Tom Stoppard, 2 one-acts, after Magritte and the Real Inspector Hound. And that they were some of the funniest parts that year.
But that was it.
Then I did a Broadway one-night stand that opened and closed in one night.
Oh, really?
And I did some theater in the park. But that was it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did you like doing that, or did you
No, I mean, and everything I did at Carnegie Mellon was theater training.
Yeah.
It was meant to send you out in the repertory company world, and we just didn't. We all went to New York, but
it might be fun to do something with Mary, huh?
It would. It is fun, but it is so all-consuming. If you do a play at night, you wake up preparing that.
Here we go. Yeah.
And I would hate to, you know, be with my wife, who I love hanging around and doing nothing
and turn it
into a neurotic day.
Yes.
Yeah. No. But if we did it together, it'd be all right.
You hope. Maybe you don't push it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Let it happen.
Don't steer yourself in the wrong direction. You know, things are going all right. So, you know, how many times have you been married?
3.
Yeah. This is a good one, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. You get along with the other ones? Or you don't need to?
First marriage was, if it had been emotionally mature and honest, it would have been, hey, I'm scared. We met at Carnegie.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
got married there. It was like, hey, I'm scared to go to New York by myself. Are you? Oh, great. Let's get an apartment together.
Yeah.
That would have been the truth.
And
somehow we got married. So remained good friends.
Oh, that's good.
Don't see each other, but... You know, left.
No kids with that one.
Actually, the no. And the separation moment was brilliant because she was learning how to sign the death.
Oh, yeah.
For
really?
A part she was doing at the circle and the rep. And so she would work on it, and then she would teach me, and we would be doing stuff for a couple months. And
signing?
Then finally, signing. And finally, one night I said, let's have a real conversation because I'll probably follow more closely if it's real. And then 45 minutes later, we were, separated.
You did it in sign?
Yeah. Because you didn't have time. You didn't have words to dick around with, a surplus of words. So you just got right to it.
And that's what she chose to do.
Yeah, we both did. And it was very sweet because it was like, the question was, where do you want to be 5 years from now? And both of us came up with somewhere else, knowing you were okay.
Yeah.
It was very sweet.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
That seems, that would have liked to have seen that.
Yeah.
That whole... That seems like an interesting device for a play.
Yeah,
people learning sign and then only being able to have that like really communicate emotionally.
Yeah,
because you can't cheat.
Yeah,
you can't manipulate.
Exactly.
Or squirm out of it.
Yeah,
weasel.
Your hands don't lie.
That's right. That's something. And the second wife, you had a couple of kids.
Couple of kids, yes. 15 years, and then met Mary, and...
Oh, that's right. You had that thing with Whoopi, too. I remember that.
That's true. That's accurate. Yeah. There's so many... Everyone's still, up and around and walking, so it's very hard to talk about.
Sure.
But it was a big moment in my life.
Are you guys friends?
Not really. I mean, nothing unfriendly went on, but no.
Yeah.
No. You know, unless your previous, the person you're dating or with or whatever embraces your new person you're with and you all become these best buddies, you're not going to stand.
Well, as long as it's not hostile.
Because
I ask people a lot of times, I assume everyone, but I look at my own life. And I'm like, how many friends do you really have? I mean, you know a lot of people, and you may have had relationships with a lot of people, but how many do you really have time? How many are you talking to?
Yeah.
Three.
Exactly.
Four. Two.
Yeah. Yes.
And then occasionally you're like, holy shit, that guy called?
Yes.
I haven't talked to him in 6 years. I love that guy.
You have a lot of people you go, hey. When I see you next time in line on a red carpet, give you a hey, and I'll give you also a hug, which will buy some time for me to go, Mark, dude.
We had such a good time in the garage. How's everything going? Good for you. So, all right. So, NBC was kind of funny about the Good Place, and my girlfriend loves the show, and they were funny in that they were, I felt like they were, I wanted to ask you something else, though, before I got to that. You work with Jack Lemmon.
I did. Yes. Yeah.
In a movie called. It was funny. There was a period there where you were going to be the new guy in the movies in the 80s.
Yeah.
The funny movies.
Yeah. I finished that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I handled that.
Like there's some I was looking through your stuff and I'm like a fine mess with Howie Mandel. Both of you. That was the big shot, right?
Yeah, that did not go well. I was thrilled that I got to work with Blake Edwards, who was like a legend.
Yeah,
but no, that he was kind of depressed.
Blake was.
Yeah, I mean for real. I think he had Epstein Barr or something like that. So he would come out of his trailer.
That was popular for a while.
Yeah, it was.
He
came out of his trailer
and
he'd say, let me see what you're going to do. And this is rehearsal. And so you'd...
comedy bits.
Yeah, no, for the movie.
Yeah.
And so we would run the scene and he goes, is that how you want to do it? Yes. And he'd go, okay, light it and walk off. He'd come back to the set once it was lit and he'd say, action. And you would do the scene, he'd say, cut. And he'd walk back to his trailer. And Blake Edwards... his kind of style was that roving master where people would be talking in the foreground and something funny would be happening in the background.
Yeah.
So he rarely did coverage where you would come in and do a single and a two shot and things like that. So literally every time he said action, you were in the movie. There was no retakes. There was no take two. Literally everything you did, that one shot you had at it was in the movie, which is very exciting. But if the script isn't quite working or the story's not quite working, then the movie has these huge.
Yeah, I don't remember it, the movie.
No, you wouldn't have. It came and went very quickly.
But Jack Lemmon, it seems to me that, like, though I did not remember seeing Dad either, and this is not an indictment or judgment, but it seems like people who worked with Jack Lemmon would have a tremendous experience as an actor.
You know, well,
did you?
Yes, and it was Jack Lemmon.
Yeah,
you know,
like what was it like watching someone like that? What do you glean
first
from
off,
that?
It was he was, I guess it. I would have to go with the delight.
Yeah.
Of performing, he was a ham bone.
Uh huh.
Sometimes. And he would had no shame.
Yeah.
So he would chew up scenery and you would almost not say your next line. You were so dumbfounded that, really? Are you going to do that? But because he had that much delight and freedom to allow himself to do that, you know, when he brought it back a smidge or something, he would knock your socks off.
Oh, so, yeah?
Yeah, it was like...
Well, he had that way of kind of like almost a bumbling through, he just keep going-ish.
Yes. Yeah. No, he. I'm thrilled I got to work with Blake Edwards. I'm thrilled I got to work with Jack Lemmon. I mean, part of the fun part about whatever success you've had in life is who you get to meet, talk to, hang around, work with.
Yeah.
You know? And Jack Lemmon was certainly one of those.
Yeah. I guess. It is sort of interesting just because I'm new to acting in any regularity, but like when I'm with Alison Brie and I'm doing scenes with her, there's part of me that's sort of like, oh, she's so good. Yeah,
I know.
You're in a scene and you're like, oh, she's really doing it. She's really doing it. Why am I thinking this? I must not be doing it. Does that happen to you?
Sure. Sure. It's hard. It's hard. One of the things when you're working with a legend or someone you admire hugely, you got to get over it pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'm not intimidated by it, but I'm always sort of like there are moments where I'm listening. It's usually you're into coverage, right?
Yeah.
So you've done the scene a couple of times.
Yeah.
And then like you just have that moment where you're just an audience because you're doing their coverage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're
off camera.
Right. And you're like, this is amazing. You know? and I don't always know when I'm on or off camera, which is probably good. I should probably know when I'm on, but I don't always know like where are we? You know, it's behind me, right?
That's good.
Yeah, yeah. But okay, so NBC, like my girlfriend watches The Good Place and loves it, and fortunately they were concerned that there would be spoilers, and my producer said, well, I don't think Mark's watched it, so you get to tell me what this show is, and we don't risk spoilers. But even when my girlfriend is explaining to me that, you know, well, it's not really heaven, but he's sort of a demon or an angel, like it was like, what was the pitch for you to take the job, and what is it?
Great. Okay, so. This is Mike Schur.
Yeah.
Parks and Rec.
Yeah, yeah.
And he also did many seasons of The Office.
Right, right.
So he, this was the pitch. Do we wait for airplanes like we do when we're acting?
No, not really.
No, okay.
hold for plane.
Or at least let's get a shot of it so they can see it.
Okay.
Okay, we're back. And it's lunch. No. All right. So, it's got to get my brain around this because it
seems complicated.
It's complicated.
People like
it's
it
wonderful.
Though.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. So, takes place in the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
I play the architect of this neighborhood because the afterlife is made up of hundreds of thousands of neighborhoods. And I have been an apprentice for 200 years. And this is my one shot at making this village, this neighborhood, perfect for the, I can't remember how many it is now, 290 people that come up to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Each one is filled and you have your soulmate there. It's perfect. Everything is just the perfect
dream. Right.
And Eleanor, the character Eleanor shows up.
Yeah.
Kristen Bell.
Yeah, she's
and
great.
It turns out that she is actually a clerical heir. So she's actually kind of a mediocre to bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And through a clerical heir, she comes up to my neighborhood. But because that's like a grain of sand in this perfect Swiss watch, everything starts to go nuts and go crazy. I mean, you know, trees fly.
That's funny.
Mean, everything gets nuts.
Yeah.
And so I'm overwhelmed and over my head because I wanted to create the perfect.
Yeah, you know, this is out of your hands, out of your control.
I'm middle management, right. So I'm trying to solve it. And everybody is starting to suffer. All of my, the four main characters are all unhappy and getting challenged and neurotic and everything's going wrong. And it's my fault. Then you discover halfway through the season, she confesses she's not supposed to be there. So then I realize it's not me. And so we're going to have to send her to the bad place.
Yeah.
It goes like that. By the end of the first season, what you discover is Eleanor, Kristen Bell, figures out that this is the bad place and that I'm actually a demon. And it's true.
Yeah.
And I go to my superiors and I say, let's not do it the old fashioned, throwing them in lava pits. I can get four people to torture themselves, torture each other psychologically, and it'll be so much funnier and it'll be like a living hell for them.
Yeah.
And everyone says no in the bad place. So I'm on warning. If I fuck this up, my character's really into real trouble.
Yeah.
And so then the second season was kind of, you got to see behind the curtain and you saw that everyone else except these four humans, all 280 other people, were part of my team. They were all people I auditioned from hell to, you
know, team
to play the,
for four people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To play. Well, yeah. But
hell's filled with people. Yeah. You got a lot of people down there.
And then it becomes, he gets into so much trouble in the second season that he decides to join the humans. And if you can't beat him, join him. But it's what's wonderful about the show, and which is why I think people enjoy it. It's about ethics. It's really, truly about what it means to be a good person, their consequences. And, you know, you at the end of your life, there's a point tally to everything you do, every action you take, you know, whether you buy a sandwich, read a book, whatever you're doing has a point value, positive or negative.
Right.
And depending on what it puts out into the world, if one of your actions causes something.
Is this
horrible,
the show, or are you telling me this in real life?
This is the show.
Okay.
This is the show.
The point value thing is.
Yeah.
Because now I thought you were just imparting spiritual wisdom on me.
It's pretty good. Feels that there are consequences.
Yeah, sure. Of course there are consequences, either in you or outside you.
Yeah, exactly. So at the end of your life, those point totals are, you know, added up and boom, you're either in or you're out. And it's a very high level and all of that. So you're imparting that, but it's wrapped in this kind of 9-year-old's fart humor at the same time.
Yeah.
So you're making people laugh and it has visual magic because you're in the afterlife.
You can do anything.
So you can do anything.
Yeah.
And so it's very, you know, in the back door kind of thing. You're really lecturing people about what it is to be good, but you're doing it in such a funny way that it appeals to young people too, not just adults.
Sure, it seems very like a very, those kind of things are always challenging to me, but to make it human enough for it to be engaging on that level, that's the trick of those things, because the conceit of it seems very kind of ambitious.
It is totally ambitious because literally everything, every episode ends with you going, oh, I get it. And then, oh, it gets flipped on its ear. So literally you're like glued to, wait, I thought I had this figured out.
Yeah.
And I think that's what audiences also really appreciate, is never getting ahead of the material. And you're never ahead of this.
Oh, yeah. No, that's good. That seemed to, like, the whole kind of like, I don't know what the hell's going to happen. That seems to be a new thing.
Yes.
You know, in terms of TV. Like, that TV is made now specifically to, on any level, you cannot guess what's going to happen.
Cable did that.
Yeah.
Cable and being able, we only do 13 episodes, which is very cool because you can create that kind of dynamic with 13. 22, you're screwed.
Like The Sopranos, I think, was one of the big ones.
Yes.
Where you're like, what's going to, you know?
Yes, but it was cable and the ability to spend
money and time.
10, 20 hours telling one story.
As opposed to just churning them out.
Yeah.
Like, what you want is, like, you want most of it. The old days, it was like, most of it has to be predictable.
Yes, and I'm tired and I want to come home and I want to know where to laugh because
I
laugh there every day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, some shows, they just do basically the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
Now, you as a person, you a spiritual person?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
I mean, but then aren't we all?
I guess. But I mean, when you talk about the afterlife and we talk about the bad place, are these in your brain? Do you believe these things?
I believe that there are consequences. I believe there are ripple effects. Sure. I believe that, you know, actually,
do you believe in going to a good or bad place after we're done?
That becomes like a matter of, I don't even think I would go there in my, I don't go there in my head.
Right.
So if I had to be nailed,
right. That's,
if I had to take an educated guess.
Yeah.
I would guess that this is
it.
This no.
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 Well, good
I
for
would
you.
Guess, but I don't think the next step is anything that would resemble anything that we could even imagine
right.
from here.
Right.
So we're not going to sit around on the right hand of God and, you know.
Right. Whatever it is, we might not know
no.
it.
But I just feel like there is, whether it's your essence, your soul, your something
mm-hmm.
is on a journey, and this is, you know, your chance to be physical and to be human and to figure stuff out and to learn by suffering or bumping into stuff
yeah.
or gravity
right.
or whatever.
Right.
That would be my kind of Buddhist Zen
guess.
Judeo-Christian kind of guess.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know.
It doesn't.
No. I think you lead your life as if it does.
Yeah.
It's kind of like acting.
Yeah.
You know, you this is imaginary shit you're doing when you act.
Yeah.
But you do it as if your life depended on it.
Right.
If you're doing it well.
Yeah.
You
right.
know, you
right.
truly do believe your imaginary, you know, circumstances.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of life to me, I think, you know.
Do you do that acting? Do you believe your imaginary circumstances usually?
Yeah. Or you let it play on you as if it did.
Yeah. I sometimes it's like that's a big jump. Like yeah, I mean play on you, but like when the cameras
when they
say cut,
yeah.
you're not like, you know, how do I get back?
No. No, I agree. And you know, and it's your job is not to be believing your circumstances. Your job is to be present.
Present and hopefully
moment.
Other people will believe.
Yes.
Right.
Because there's a story
right.
that you're telling.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
As long as the story is compelling and you're not.
Yeah. And they're not looking at you going like, he's not
yeah,
in
yeah,
it.
He's not in it. Yeah. That's one of the, I think, the neatest parts about acting.
Yeah.
You can rehearse. You can
yeah.
have great ideas. You can pump iron. You can learn how to shoot a bow and arrow. But if you are not literally in that moment where you don't know what's going to happen next and you are totally present as opposed to demonstrating what a good idea I had last night
right,
when I thought
right.
about this part
yeah.
or watch this or this is what audiences love to see. If you're not literally surrendered to, I don't know what the fuck's happening next,
right.
then it sucks.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we're all probably, if you're really good at it, you're probably 50-50.
Right, right. It's just so sad, though, like, you know, he's spent all that time learning how to shoot the bow and arrow.
Yeah. Let me show you how good I am.
The movie wasn't good because he was good at shooting the bow and arrow, but that, I mean, he didn't feel like he really was the guy doing that.
But that's fun.
Yeah.
And that's life.
It is.
You do your best you can.
I guess that's true. You make mistakes and... That was fun, right?
Yeah, no, it was.
Say hi to Larry David for me.
I will.
You know?
Sometime have me back and let me talk about oceans and Oceania and...
We can talk about him for a minute.
No.
Oh, we're in trouble.
No.
Is that what you want to tell me?
No. Nothing. I mean, seriously, I that wasn't a leading thing. I would love to come back and talk to you about what I do when I'm not doing this.
What is it? We have time. I'm not rushing you out.
No. I have to go. I've had it.
You've had
it. Here's the tease.
Yeah.
During the Cheers years, I moved into a neighborhood. It was fighting Occidental Petroleum,
yeah.
or whatever it was called, from drilling 60 oil wells in Santa Monica Bay.
Yeah.
And I became friends and co-worker with the environmental lawyer who was heading that. We succeeded in defeating them, which was astounding, and we enjoyed the conversation that we had with each other mm-hmm. and about oceans. So naively, we went, let's start an organization. And we started American Oceans Campaign, and it was about... offshore oil, coastal pollution. We had lobbyists in Washington working with us and really good staff of about 12 people. Then that lasted for 15 years. And I was I was always the actor who said, thank you for watching Cheers. Can I have a moment of your time to talk? You should hear what this marine biologist is telling. So I'm not an expert, but I was a spokesperson and have kind of learned a lot by hanging around these amazing people. Then it merged into a new organization that was founded called Oceana that was truly international.
Yeah.
We never quite got past celebrity boutique environmental organization. Mm-hmm. Oceana is now the largest in the world. Its focus is mostly on overfishing, because if you do it right and harvest fish correctly, and we know what to do that.
Yeah.
You could provide 1 billion fish meals a day. If you could quantify fish that way, you could provide 1 billion fish meals a day forever.
Yeah.
That would take stress off of land animals, off of water.
Yeah.
Off of cutting down forests, because you don't have to cut something down to grow something, to feed something. You get protein in the most clean way you can possibly get it.
Yeah.
So that's what we do. And we do it all over the world, and we're having great results. We're bumping into kind of a bad time here in this country. But it's so much fun for me to use that other side of my brain when I'm, you know, when I'm not acting, I'm doing this.
Oh, yeah, be proactive and do something for the world. It's great.
It's a great conversation.
I've never, we're bumping into a bad time here in this country. I like how you just kind of, brushed right over that. You know, and moved on to but we are having successes.
Yeah, yeah. No, all over the world, and the rest of the world.
Sure,
part of this bumpy time we're having here.
Yeah, we're just hoping this bumpy time doesn't infect all of it.
Yeah.
But well, that's great. I'm glad it's having success, and I eat fish almost exclusively now.
Me too.
I don't eat the other stuff anymore.
Eat small, eat wild, local, and small. That's the rule of thumb.
I eat wild. I don't always know if it's local. I try to, I got a fish guy I go to.
Yeah. And you probably is local.
Yeah, I think so. Some of it seems to be wild, but from farther away.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what kind of fish do you usually eat?
Sea bass.
Yeah.
I'm talking on the East Coast.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, East Coast.
Local. Yeah. Wild salmon is just unbelievable.
Seasonal, though.
It is. You know how you can tell in a restaurant when you it's always embarrassing to say
if it's wild
farm salmon or wild salmon.
The
farm
color.
Salmon, yeah.
Very orange.
Yes, but you also, you look at the side view of it, and if you see white fatty lines running through it, that's farmed.
Huh.
Because wild is out there muscling its way.
Leaner.
Yeah, leaner. Good. Anyway, sorry, this was just a...
No, it's great.
I guess I wanted you to know, Mark, to know that this is what I do when I'm not... and we
acting.
Don't have to talk about it, but when I'm not acting.
No.
But I love talking to you.
Yeah, no, it was a great time. Yeah. I enjoy talking to you, too, yeah. and I like fish, and I like the world, and I like knowing you're doing that. The thing about me that I'm concerned about is that, I need to be involved more than... Because, a lot of times you think, I say things, I talk, I'm helping. Are you helping, though?
Yeah,
sounds like you're helping.
You are.
But you're helping. You're actively engaged in it, and you enjoy it.
If you're talking to people,
want to do more,
then check out oceana.org.
Okay. Thanks, man. Ted Danson, go watch Get Caught Up with The Good Place on Netflix. Yeah, I'm going on tour. Well, there's 5 dates, all right? A few parts of the world tour. Check out the dates and cities on the tour page at WTFpod.com. It all kicks off in London, England at the Royal Festival Hall on April 16th, on through Stockholm, Oslo, Amsterdam, and Dublin. Dublin, my future home. Dublin, New Mexico, but if the country falls the wrong way and I have to run from my neighbors, I'd like it to think it would be to Ireland. I can play some guitar, I think. These strings are dead, though, man. They're dead. Boom! Boomer lives. Boomer lives. Big Head, too. I saw Big Head out there. He's still hanging around, but I know other people are feeding him, so don't freak out, all right?